This is Bob Pittman for the Legal Line Network. You're listening to Legal Line. I remember saying the Pledge of Allegiance in elementary school. I recall learning it so that it could be said by heart, but I don't remember exactly when, and I don't recall much about the schoolroom where we all learned it. I met Mako Nakagawa recently. She is a past president of the Seattle chapter of the Japanese American Citizen League, and she supported the redress efforts on behalf of the 27 school clerks who were forced to resign from the Seattle Public Schools in 1942 because they were of Japanese ancestry. Currently, she facilitates workshops for teachers and students on the Japanese American experience during World War II. Mako Nakagawa learned the Pledge of Allegiance as a 5-year-old from behind barbed wire with armed U.S. soldiers keeping a watchful eye on her. Listen to the story told by Mako Nakagawa.
This story is called With Liberty and Justice for All Through the Years. I learned the Pledge of Allegiance as a child prisoner behind the barbed wire fences of American concentration camps. There I was, 5-year-old inmate, with her hand over her heart, reciting, "With liberty and justice for all." In truth, I learned to say the words of the pledge by rote without learning the meaning of the words. I didn't know what a pledge was, nor did I know many of the other words. Two of the words were difficult for me to even pronounce. I remember practicing saying indivisible and allegiance over and over again. It wasn't until years later that those words began to take on meaning for me. I started wondering if the teachers of those days in camp understood the irony that teachers today are so quick to recognize. Did they teach by rote, just as I was expected to learn by rote? Or were they shaken by the inherent contradiction between the governmental words and the governmental action? I recall a time when my sister tried to explain the word indivisible by talking about a piece of candy from one candy bar. I saw no connection, but I nodded my head in agreement when she asked if I understood. This was the only lesson I ever received of a child to help me understand the pledge. At 5, I learned the pledge as a series of words. It didn't matter that it made no sense to me at all. That was 1940s. As a teenager in the 1950s, the pledge became a wonderful American promise that allowed me a comfortable sense of belonging and of patriotic pride. I am loath to admit that I also felt a tinge of smugness. I swelled with tearful pride and abject loyalty just watching the American flag pass by. About this time, I became involved in a controversy over the proposal to add 2 more words to the pledge. I was passionately opposed to the addition of "under God." I argued with the class as well as with individuals expressing my opposition. I did not consider myself an atheist, but I thought that excluding the atheist by adding these 2 words seemed un-American and wrong. Freedom of religion to me meant that one always had the option to not have a religion. I was sorely disappointed when the addition was accepted. I vowed never to utter those words when I recited the pledge. As a college student, I became questioning the validity of the people as symbols of inalienable rights and unwavering principles of American democracy. I got caught up in the challenge of the mood in the 1960s. I developed a swagger along with my growing assertiveness. I decried my childhood learning of the pledge as hypocrisy in action. Barring from the black community, I was shouting, "Yellow is beautiful." When I became a mother of 3 by 1970s, my outlook shifted dramatically. Protest posters were put aside, and the questions of the moment became, should Darren be allowed another cookie before dinner? Did Deanne's diaper rash need a doctor's attention? Did Bradley need new shoes? Thoughts of the pledge were far removed from family life. However, a decade later, I realized my children were affected by the society around them. Perhaps I should consider social activism again. Soon my pledge was back. The pledge was back in my life. I began my teaching profession. My day with the second graders began with a pledge. I fumbled with all the challenges facing a new teacher. The pledge was simply a rote part of the morning exercise. It was most humbling and disheartening to become aware that I became part of the problem and not part of the solution. Maybe my teachers in camp were just like me, simply overwhelmed teachers. I will never know. In the 1980s, I became principal of a Seattle elementary school. Whenever possible, I went from classroom to classroom doing the morning routine, which included the Pledge of Allegiance. I was careful to mouth under God to set the proper example for the students, but I never did voice those two specific words. I continued to silently object to those words. It often struck me as remarkable that I was an adult modeling the teaching of the pledge. Neither the students nor the teachers were aware of the circumstances under which I learned the pledge. But I did make it a point to encourage teachers to discuss the meaning of the pledge with their students. By the 1990s, my personal and professional life became so profoundly changed. The only times I recall even reciting the pledge was at the few openings of the Mariner games that I attended. By the end of the decade, I was partially retired and looking forward to enjoying more leisure time. I planned to indulge in mindless entertainment, which I felt I deserved. The talent, skills, knowledge, and self-confidence of the younger generation comforted me. I would leave it to them to address the social issues of the day and the future. The pledge just receded in the far reaches of my awareness. I was intent on relishing the joys and leisures of retirement. The first decade of the new millennium was not only a loud wake-up call for America, it was a huge shake-up call for me. After September 11, the ubiquitous hysteria, the fear of anyone who looked Middle Eastern was appalling. Stories from the Muslim Arab Sikh communities had a ring that was much too familiar. Children were called names in schools. People were spit upon, harassed, fired from jobs. Property vandalized, people were beaten up or even murdered, and homes and businesses were vandalized and raided. Our stories from the 1940s, the stories from the newly targeted communities, were frighteningly similar. And there was a feeling of deja vu in the Japanese-American communities. Fear, fanned by media, fueled hysteria. The government increased its power to intrude and detain people at the cost of civil liberties, and targeted groups suffered from government actions. Guilt based on group identity perpetrated selected groups by those who understood so little of the group's history or culture. The consistent and constant message from the Japanese American community is clear. Quote, let the legacy of the Japanese-American incarceration in 1942 be that no group of people will ever have to go through a similar experience, unquote. Ancestry is not a crime. The government imprisoned me at the age of 5 to 9 based solely on my ancestry. Two-thirds of the 120,000 people imprisoned in concentration camp during World War II were American citizens. I felt a renewed sense of urgency to share our story from the past to express what American patriotism means to me today. I got off my comfortable duff to do my part to remind people of the past to make sure that history does not repeat itself. My pledge is not just words memorized by rote, not just pie-in-the-sky idealism, not cynical, brainwashed verbiage. I know now that my pledge is what I make it to be. I hope to help make the pledge come alive again and remain firmly rooted in the American ideal of liberty and justice for all. Not liberty and justice for all, but them. Thank you. This is Mako Nakagawa. That's one of the stories I have written. I guess I got a little carried away, but essentially I think it's so crucial that we treasure our civil liberties and honor our Constitution. So I'm still back at it. Thank you.
You're listening to Legal Line on the Legal Line Network. As you're remembering when and where you learned the Pledge of Allegiance, Mako Nakagawa helps us with another story, this time showing us a humorous side to a serious story.
Okay, the title of this story is Onara. As a child, I never realized that it was unusual for my life to have been thoroughly dominated with people of Japanese ancestry. Then I recalled one teacher reading Little Black Sambo to our class. I was intrigued. Aside from the scattering of white people who seemed distant from the real people, this was a first introduction to people that were different from us. Little Black Sambo was so cute, and the tigers running around the tree and turning into butter was fantastic. The teacher explained to us that the story was from the author's imagination. I wondered if the black people with huge eyes and jet black skin were part of that imagination along with the transformation of tigers into butter. How strange that my specialty as a professional multicultural educator might have been launched from this resoundingly discredited book. My knowledge of white people was based on slightly more practical information. My teachers and the guards were white. The magazine and films were filled with white people. We had a name for their group. They were Hakujin, and we were Nihonjin. Even to us young kids, it was apparent that they were the folks with power. From very early on, we were taught to be wary of them, but I hardly think I was alone in being curious about them. One day, we were fully immersed in laughter as we took turns pressing our lips to the back of our hand and blowing hard. Each sound we produced resulted in a fresh round of hilarity. Every kid made a different sound, and each one was a variation of onara. We knew that if the adults caught us in this, they would certainly disapprove, which made the humor even more delicious. What fun to be naughty. There must have been at least a dozen of us second graders trying to make the most obnoxious onara sound that we could. We commented that on the various sounds produced. Then Akira produced a sound that was hands down the most interesting of all. He had pressed a leaf between the palms of his hands and blew into the nearly closed hands. Somehow the vibrating leaf produced a warbling sound that was simply perfect. He drew uproarious laughter. Some of the kids even rolled on the hard-packed dirt ground. I liked Akira. I was happy to see a number of boys begging him to share his trick. He glanced at me with a smile as he revealed his secret to the waiting boys. About this time, someone voiced a question that started a long discussion. Why is it Hakujins don't onara? There was lots of conjecture. Half of us thought they did, and the other half thought they didn't. They're human, they must do it. I argued that if they did do it, they would have to have a name for it. Since none of us knew the English word for onara, it must mean they didn't do it. There were no Hakujins we could ask. The only Hakujins we had direct contact with were teachers or military guards. We certainly couldn't ask them. My best friend Janet thought she heard one coming from her teacher. It was not conclusive because a teacher moved her chair at the same time. The teacher either was very clever in using the chair to cover her embarrassment, or the chair made the sound. I knew Hakujins were different from us, but it seemed strange that there was no English word for onara. It also seemed strange that their body would function differently from ours. I asked Mama what she thought. She just smiled and said she had no idea because she hasn't been around Hakujins very much. She implied she wouldn't want to know them well enough to answer my question. One day I was alone with Janet and the subject came up again. We finally came to the conclusion that the only logical explanation was as follows. Onara was a result of what one ate. Since Hakujins ate differently from us, it made sense that their food simply did not produce onara. I never learned how to eat non-onara producing Hakujin food as I once planned. However, as time went by, I did learn such words such as fart, passing gas, cut the cheese, flatulent. Aha, they did do it after all. One more mystery about white people solved. Well, we're not so different after all. Hello, this is Mako Nakagawa. That's one of the stories I wrote for my manuscript. I hope I could say in the future a book that I hope to publish. I tried to keep the tone of a little girl being in camp, not and having so many things just right over my head. I also tried to reflect some of the old lady looking back on what happened and put it in that perspective also. Essentially, what I really want to do is have people who read the book understand that we were just people. We cried, we laughed, we dreamt, we're ordinary people. And this should not happen. We need to make sure it doesn't happen again. Thank you.
We thank Mako Nakagawa for sharing two of her stories with us. We're working on a documentary program that will air in November 2010 on the Japanese-American experience in World War II. Be sure to watch for more details. You can find us at bobpittman.com and on Facebook at Legal Line with Bob Pittman. Next week, we will explore neighbor law. You won't want to miss it.